I would like to tell you a story. Knife Talk is sponsored by Evenheat, the manufacturers of the finest knife treat ovens available. Find your next heat treat oven at evenheat-kiln.com.
Welcome to Knife Talk, episode 78. So today it's just myself and Jeff. So me, I'm Craig Lockwood of Chop Knives, and I'm joined by, every week, by Jeff Fader of Fader Knives. Now, normally we have Mareko Malmasi with us, but it's his son's birthday, and quite rightly, family comes first. So he's spending the day dressed up as a princess at this kid's birthday party. He's going to have a great time, I'm sure, but yeah, he'll be back next week. Yeah. So what's up, Jeff? What have you been up to?
Well, happy birthday to his son, number one,
little
first
Beck,
and foremost.
Little Beck.
It's, you know, it was a very tough week. It was a tough week. I started making these knives. I did a collaboration with Chef Carl Ruiz, who I've been dealing with for the past few years, and he designed a knife, and I started working on these 50 El Bandito knives, and they're this fun little, it's like a hybrid between a culinary knife and like a bushcrafty knife, and it's as Carl wanted it to be for tailgating and home defense. So that's the whole point. So this week was just like grinding. So I was grinding away all week, pre-grinding all the blades. It was brutal. 50 knives, just standing in front of the grinder and realizing that I'm going to have to buy some new motors for my grinders. My grinder motors are starting to break hit the breaker. Yeah. So I'm just kind of, you know, so it was a lot of drudgery this week and tough stuff. That's how we do. Listen, that's it, you know? I don't know what else to say.
It's not all high fives and hand jobs.
Hand jobs? What? Hand jobs? Oh, man, no hand jobs. Thank God damn it. That's a good one. I should use that from now on, hand jobs.
High fives and hand jobs.
Yeah. Well, you know, it's funny because, you know, I think a lot of our listeners some of them are full-time makers, part-time makers. And you get to this point where if you're in your shop and you're working for someone and you just think that, you know, I my boss is a dick, or I can't believe I can't wait to leave the shop because they're being a dick, or I can't wait to leave this job. Ugh, I'm so sick of working with this guy, and he's a dick. And then all of a sudden, you finally pull the plug, and you're working for yourself, and all of a sudden, you lose that security blanket of the job, and now all of a sudden, the bills come, and the pressure, and then all of a sudden you realize, wait a second, I'm the dick. Yeah. I got to work for the dick. And it's like, you know, it's not easy, but, you know, boom, yeah. It's...
different pressures. You got nobody telling you what to do, but the buck stops with you. I think that's the thing, isn't it?
Well, the bills are telling you what to do. The overhead's telling you what to do. It sucks. It sucks to a certain degree because, you know, everything grass is always... grass is greener on the other side, but, you know, you have to kind of bite down and just kind of be like, all right, well, these, you know, you gotta make some shit. You gotta make it happen. And it's kind of like, it's not, like you said, it's not all hand jobs.
How many Bandidos are you making?
I'm making 50.
Oh, nice.
We sold 50. And now I'm actually waiting for the handle material to come in. This is the last bit of the material to come in. It's a lot of G10. And everything's looking good. Everything's looking good. I actually just finished the file work on the spines, and now I'm just kind of like, because it's stainless, they're short knives. I mean, they're you know, the blade's like, you know, under 5 inches. It's a short knife. It goes a lot faster, but because I'm plate quenching it, because they're stainless steel, I can take off a little bit more material, and I'm not really having to worry about a distal taper. So it's much more streamlined in that sense. There's going to be a lot less grinding after heat treatment, which makes me a little bit happier, because when I was doing the Cuban knives last year, it was there were 9-inch chef knives. It took a long time to grind after heat treatment. These are shorter, so
what sort of finish are you going to go with?
You know what? I'm unfortunately for me, I always do hand sanded satin finish.
Yeah,
and it's one of those things. I just like the look. I really really like the look of a satin finish. I know a lot of guys do off the belt finish, and I think that look, people do a great job. I don't think that mine look is good. I like a satin finish. That satin finish where the line's going from the heel to the tip, it just kind of gives you this visual. To me, when I see that, it makes me see the knife as a directional thing, and you get to see the lines kind of like your the lines lead your eye down the blade, and I just think that it looks a little sharper, but it's a total sacrifice of time.
You're gonna have biceps like a king. 50 stainless blades. Oof.
Wow, the bicep! I'm gonna have carpal tunnel in my hands. Yeah. You know, it's like you know, talk about hand jobs. I mean, it's like, you know, I have to I'm constantly remaking my paddles because if your paddles aren't like ergonomic, you put your hands to sleep. You know, you can really, and then not to mention all the calluses. Look, what am I going to talk about? My hands all the time? You know, how are you? What's going on with you?
I'm good. It's been a good week. It's prepping scales for restaurant orders, stabilizing, and a lot of prep work. What I'm tending to do now is I've got sort of restaurant orders backed up, so I can prep a bunch of scales at once, stabilize a bunch at once, and do it that way. Yesterday was a bit of a break, so there was a Fête de Couteau, which we talked about very briefly last week, which is a knife show here in Nontron. And it was good. It was really, really good to see. It was a blistering hot day, and it was all outdoors, so it was really nice. I bought a bunch of wood, which I picked up from the supplier at the place as well, which is really nice. And just good to see faces and see what people are working on. There's a definite sort of style with the French makers. They like to keep everything sort of a brute de force, I suppose. You can see their workings out. Very different to what I do. Really good. Lots of inspiration. Everybody selling the same knife.
How many people do you think came to that event?
I'd say there's probably 5,000 visitors.
Oh my God.
It's a 2-day event. It's on today as well, but I mean, 1 day is enough, to be honest with you.
But that's different from the event you went to in Thiers, right?
Yeah. So Thiers is, that's the big one that they do. What's it called? Oh, Coutelier. That's the big one every year. So in France, we've got two sort of knife making areas. One is Thiers, which is, you know, the Laguioles, all that kind of things. And the other one is Nontron. And they do what they call the Périgord knife, which is a folding knife, quite similar to a Laguiole and a Thiers style knife. But it's their own sort of version of that. So, and that's only about 30, 40 minutes from me. So, yeah, it was a nice trip, lovely drive to get there through the countryside, beautiful. Just really nice, really nice. But it just amazes me how they've had these traditional shapes for, you know, decades and decades and decades. And you go from table to table, and it's the same thing, just with a different handle on. It's crazy. Great, different handle.
So how do they do a lot of who comes to those things? Is it like restaurant buyers or
no?
Who's coming to those things?
There's very much a different sort of culture here in France. Certainly, what I'm used to in the UK, where everybody carries a knife. You're allowed to carry, you know, any knife that you like. So everybody carries a knife, particularly where we are because we're very rural. Right. There's a lot of farmers, a lot of sort of, you know, field workers, that kind of thing. So they've always got a knife on them. So, yeah, the customer going to those things are just, you know, Joe Public. And people do generally have a sort of, you know, they like knives here. It's in their culture. You see housewives, looking at the knives and appreciating the knives. It's nice to see.
So it sounds to me like these aren't super expensive knives.
Well... my wife came with me yesterday, and she was like, "Well, what's the difference between that knife and that knife? Because that knife is 100 euros, and that one's 1,000 euros." And I walked away myself at times thinking, "Yeah, I wonder what is the difference."
Well, it makes a lot of sense. I mean, it makes a lot of sense in regards to who the customers are. Like, if you go to the Blade Show, a lot of times there's certain people who are going for the little, you know, the Spider Cos and the little kind of like under $100, folding knives, and then there are collectors going to get, you know, buying expensive knives from, you know, master bladesmiths. So I'm wondering if that's a, if that's the whole thing at an event like this, where if it's farmers and stuff like that, are they just like, they fucked up their old knife and now it's time to get a new one?
Well, it's weird because, like you just said, you know, people either go for something like a Spyderco or, you know, a branded knife or something more custom. But the designs are all the same here. So that, you know, that typical tier shape, the Lagiol shape, everybody yeah. does that design. So then differentiating yourself from another, you know, to totally different price level, I don't see how they do it. I'm flummoxed by it. It's this tradition, this thing of tradition sort of strangling people, you know, where they stick to tradition and it's stopping people moving on. And I find it really strong. I can't get my head around it. But there's a few people doing something different, which is nice to see. And there's very few chef knives, table knives, that kind of thing. Mainly folders, or the big factories there selling their sort of Lagiol table knives, that kind of thing.
But it's not that surprising that they would be the same. I mean, if you talk about, especially in France, if you look at the culture of their food, I mean, there are certain recipes that have been handed down for, you know, hundreds and hundreds of years, and then they haven't changed. I mean, they're used to this specific recipe, they're used to a specific style, and it's not a surprise that they don't really kind of, you know.
Yeah, well, I mean, the restaurant industry here in France, I'd say 10 years ago, it was on its arse because it was relying on tradition. It was relying on the old staples, hadn't moved forward with the times, and almost had an arrogance about it as well. And I'd say 10 years ago, food in France was stuck in the 70s, particularly in sort of Paris, those areas. It was just stuck, and the rest of the world had moved on, and they were being left behind. But I'd say over the last 7, maybe 8 years, restaurants are changing, and they're doing sort of modern stuff. So they're keeping their classics, but they're sort of modernizing them for a modern palate, that kind of thing. But the French hang on to their traditions like crazy. Yeah. And it comes across as an arrogance sometimes, as I say, certainly with the food it did. But yeah, they are slowly moving with it. They're being dragged out of the 70s.
Yeah. Well, speaking of, I know you were talking about, what were you stabilizing? What kind of wood were you stabilizing?
Walnut. So, I mean, it's French walnut, so it's pretty hard anyway, but I like to stabilize stuff, even if it is hard wood, because it will take on some stuff, and it will polish up better as well than, even an oily hard wood. Polish is nice, but if it's stabilized, you know, it gets that. What's the word? Chatoyance. That's the new word we learned. That's right. So
and
yeah,
the chatoyance comes from the way a tree grows, and then the pressure of the oils and the grains and stuff like that, and that's how you create that.
Yeah,
I guess. But I was interested. Speaking of which, I was talking to who let the dogs out.
Let the dogs out.
That's right. There you go. Two for one. That's a two for one. We just barely started this goddamn thing, and we're already hitting the beepers. So. A lot of people were sending me nice messages in regards to when Jonathan was on. We're talking about the stabilizing, and I talk to him pretty frequently. And one of the things that's always been a problem for me with stabilizing, I don't really stabilize a pile of wood. I usually buy a lot of wood. I'll be honest with you, I get a lot of wood from Rob's Wildwood. He makes great wood. I buy a lot of his. We call my friends, Jeremy Spake calls it fruity wood because it's all colorful. Looks like a bowl of fruity pebbles. That's fine. So a lot of times when I'm stabilizing, I do a lot of stuff around here, Hudson Valley stuff. I use a friend of mine's got a lumber yard, and he gives me some, you know, things that they can't stabilize and stuff that'd be perfect for knives. So when I started getting into stabilizing, I was reading about the pump and how you're supposed to do the suck and everything. And I would start turn the vacuum on, and it would be towards the end of the day, and I thought, I can't leave this on all night. You know, it's number one, it's going to ruin my neighbor's going to kill me, and it's going to ruin the pump. So I started to turn it off, and then I would, start it up again the next day. I would release the pressure and start it up again the next day. And then I was under the impression, I've read certain things, that it's, not as good to do. So then what I would do is I just come in early on days I was going to stabilize. And it just seemed like it was just an inefficient way to kind of manage your time and manage the stabilizing. So what Jonathan was telling me is, because he's not to mention just a knife maker, but he's also a doghouse forge. He also is a farrier. So he's not in the shop all the time, too. So he was having the same issues. So what he did was he told me what you should do is you should change the plumbing of your little chamber and put a shutoff valve before the chamber starts.
Yeah.
So you have your pump, then your line that leads to your chamber, and then the gauge is on the chamber, blah, blah, blah. He says, if you put a shutoff valve in front of the chamber, you can start sucking. Lock the pressure in, and then you actually can shut off. You can close the shutoff, and the chamber will be, I don't know, for lack of a better word, charged at that vacuum pressure. And then you can turn off your pump, fuck away off, and then you can start it back up again. And he was referring to it as like a pause button. And apparently this is something that a lot of stabilizers do, because obviously you can't have your pump running for, days on end. Some woods take a lot longer to stabilize than others. And he says, and what you can do is, you just start it back, next day you come back in, you start it back up. You give it a couple hours here, a couple hours there. And then what you're doing is you're putting a pause button on your stabilizing. So I did all the plumbing, and then, I had one problem. I turned it on. I was like, oh, this is fucking great. And all of a sudden, I started to see the oil from the tank, from the pump, start going up the line. Well, you need to, with my pump, it doesn't, when the pump is turned off, it doesn't backfeed the pressure, so it doesn't kind of slowly release. So what I had to do is I had to make like a little quick release and then just bleed the lines before the oil would kind of, I had to release the pump for the most part. So that was something that really kind of, it was a game changer for me, because now I'm able to, put a pause button on pumping of the wood, and then all of a sudden get better results.
Yeah, starting again.
You're not starting again.
It's what I do, because I'm nervous about leaving the pump on, and I wouldn't leave it on overnight, because again, it burns oil and it's not something you'd want to leave on.
Right.
But yeah, my plumbing is basically the same. So I've got my pump, I then have a shut-off valve, I then have my entrance into the chamber with a dial showing pressure, and then I have another shut-off valve before I have my air filter.
Right.
So when I want to let air in, it comes through a filter before, when I do the shutoff valve, before it goes into the chamber. It works really well. So you can just hold that pressure in. So it's no longer sucking. So you're not putting positive pressure on, but you are just holding the pressure where it is.
Oh man. All of a sudden I'm like, I don't have to come in early. I don't have to come in early to make sure I have a good 12-hour window. I don't have to leave it on and then come back in the middle of the night, which I've done before. And I'm also under the impression that it's good for when you're doing dyes. If you're dyeing the resin, what Jonathan says is sometimes if you run the suck, for lack of a better term, and then turn it off and then release the pressure, and it's sitting in the dye, and then you start it up the next time, you might get a difference in the color. There might be a more concentrated area from the first suck to the second suck. It fucking sucks. But I mean, I was super pumped because super pumped. Get another one? That was a good one. Jesus Christ. But it was a huge thing for me, because now all of a sudden, I don't have to, think too hard about how I'm doing the stabilizing, and I can kind of do it on my own. You can do it on your own time, which is great.
Well, funnily enough, I was speaking to Jonathan myself this week, just yesterday, regarding stabilizing. So, because this is walnut that I'm doing, a huge, loads and loads of walnut. And because it's obviously pretty hard, what I didn't want to do is put blocks in, knowing that I'm never going to penetrate into the middle. So I've cut down to scales first.
Right.
But obviously, when you bake, you're going to get this runoff, and you're going to get this crud along the edges.
Yeah.
So Jonathan was saying, well, you probably should have left it as a block and so on. So the way I'm getting around that now is, when I'm baking, I have a metal tray underneath.
Right.
But then I'm just putting it just like a, the grills that you have in an oven.
Yeah.
So I'm having one of them just 2 inches above that, so I can stand my scales up, and they're leaning on this grill, standing up.
Right.
So then any drip out that you get will just be collected at the bottom. You don't get crud on one edge. instead of, you know, a top edge, a face. And it seems to be working well. So, yeah, so that's it's working well.
His tip from two episodes ago where he says wipe down the wood before you wrap it up was there wasn't as much runoff. There was definitely not as much runoff when I did it. But, you know, look, hand jobs and high fives. This is fine.
But I also spoke to Jonathan about something else this week. Jeez, he's been featuring heavy in our lives.
Yeah, apparently he's a wanted man.
Yeah,
apparently. Go ahead.
He sent me a screenshot of another company with a very similar name to mine, and he was like, "Oh, have you got yours trademarked, protected in any way?" And I was like, "Oh, sort of. I've talked about it in the past and all the rest of it." But it got me thinking.
Another Chop Knives?
It's Chop Something Knives, yeah. They've just put one extra letter in. So there's a couple out there already.
Yeah,
one of them has a logo that's very, very similar to mine, but it is what it is. So speaking to my wife, her sister actually works in the patent office in the UK.
Right.
So the patent office, they also do trademarks, copyright. It's all in one government office.
Yeah.
So we were on the phone to her, and we're going to sort out the trademark. So it's UK, EU, and worldwide, and it's a hell of a thing. So there's also something called registering your designs as well, which I didn't know. So there's trademarking, there's copyrighting, there's obviously patenting, which patenting wouldn't be relevant, but you can also register your designs. So, for example, your Bandito or your Cuban. They're specific designs and use this. What's going on?
Why do you keep hitting everything?
Oh, jeez. As if it's a joke. Oh,
I'm like waiting for something. I'm not paying attention or something. Go ahead.
But these specific designs can be registered, so nobody can do that exact design. So, for example, you know, calling something a Cuban and it looks like you're Cuban. There have been quite a few sort of mimics out there. This would put an end to that, and it's super, super cheap. But it's just admin work.
I'm going to start sending cease and desist letters, and then they're going to, you know, that this is an interesting situation because. You know, I understand where you're coming from in regards to the name of your company, the logo of your company, the design of your company. But like when it comes to knife making, I think that you can't start suing people over knife designs.
I think if you've got something as specific as yours, as you say, your Bandito and your Cuban, they're very specific, even the colorways that you use in, you know, it's...
What, I'm going to sue somebody because I'm going to put a black handle on?
Well, no, if they got the same blade and they've got the same handle and they're calling it the Cuban, that's an obvious ripoff my book.
I think that if you got to have like, a three-parter. You can't just, you know, I get very like, this is not art. I'm going to say it a million times. And it's like, we're all going off of, you know, when I talk about the way I make my knives, there's slight evolutions on each other. So when I designed the Cuban, it was legitimately, when I was talking to Carl Weiss, he said, I want something sinister. So I took one of my knife designs. I'm like, all right, let's put a swedge on the back, a harpoon clip, or let's make it a little bit more sinister. Let's make that curl it a little bit. I mean, I took inspirations from like fighting knives. So like you could very much say to me, that doesn't look like, I mean, that's not an original design. I was really like taking my knife and then making add-ons to kind of push it into the direction that he was looking for. I would be hard sell to a hard, you know, it's not the most original design. I don't even think I could, I wouldn't even know where to begin. I mean, yes, people have been saying, you know, people have been, you know, I think when you start to look at, you know, whose designs what, and you start sending cease and desist orders, I think the only people who are going to win are the lawyers. It's going to be a lot of problems.
Let's say my circumstance. So I'm working with a sort of a high profile chef at the moment on a signature line for them. I'd be so pissed off if I saw somebody else do exactly the same, using the same materials, exactly the same shape, and calling it a similar name when they're it's clear what they're doing. They're trying to sort of trade off something that I've done, and you know, and I've seen people doing that with your knives, particularly with your Cuban. They're, you know, they're calling it something very similar. They're using exactly the same materials, exactly the same design.
But it's, this is something that's going to happen. There are people who learn how to make knives from other people, and they get influence from that person. It's, there's not a whole, I mean, this is the reason why it gets me so crazy, because this is like, no one's come up with an original idea that's like different, super, super. I mean, when I look at other knife makers and I'm looking at the guys who are the most innovative, they've set themselves apart to the point where if you rip them off, hey, listen, Tomer from Florentine Knives is getting ripped off left and right all through Europe from these. There's some French guys who are making his knives.
Those French.
I'm telling you. I'm telling you, man, I actually sent a message to him like somebody's dipping in. You know, you look at China right now, the guys who are making iPhones, who are manufacturing iPhones, they were making their own version of the iPhone too. These people are like, they're, as long as you see some money, you're gonna figure out a way to get it over on someone. I appreciate what you're saying, and I appreciate the concept of protecting your brand, and I envy you, and I'm, you know, but at the same time, I feel like it's like you're fighting a, you might, in certain circumstances, I'm not going to copyright any of my knives. I'm not going to copyright the designs. I can't do it. It's just in my mind. I'm just like, I honestly feel if I'm putting all my eggs in this one basket, and if I can't be more innovative to do better than what somebody else is doing, then it's my fault.
But what I'm saying is it's your work. You've done it first. So it's not a case of you having to innovate to be better than these people.
I mean, based on what? Based on what other people have seen on Instagram? I think it'd be hard. I'm not 100% sure it is the case. I think that you're being very kind, and I think that you're being very kind. I just don't think that I can do it. I mean, yes, when I see someone, and recently people have been like crediting me for things, which is always very kind, and I always send a picture to Tony, and I say, here's another one. But what are you going to do? Tony and I just curse, and we say shitty things about you behind your back, and then that's the end of it. Motherfucker. Yeah, that's it. You want to hear what happens? That's what happens. Tony and I get on the phone like, that motherfucker right there, this son of a bitch right there, and that's it.
Let's move on with the news. News this week in the knife world. So, first of all, a massive congratulations to Mareko. He's not with us today, but he did this massive auction for this amazing, I'm sure you've all seen the pictures of this amazing knife, featured in Vogue. It was, yeah, just beautiful. And he auctioned it, and it seemed to go really well. So I hope somebody's very, very happy with the new knife that they're going to be getting.
Yeah, congratulations.
Congratulations to his son. It's his son's birthday today. I think he's three, just three. So congratulations to little Vic.
And
happy birthday.
We might as well say it. Happy birthday to Jonathan Porter, Doghouse Forge. It's his birthday too.
Again, Jonathan Porter.
Yesterday, yeah.
Jeez.
Let the dogs out!
Son of a...
Left a presence with us.
Ah, please. I hope you have a power outage. I can't take any more of that.
Other news I wanted to talk about is I've seen the Instagram of doing this weird, I don't know if it's an experiment or whether it's going to be forever, but they're removing follow accounts and like counts on posts. So, for example, I know they're doing it in Australia. They've started rolling out in Australia and different countries. I'm not sure if it's going to be a worldwide thing. And I'm not really sure of the purpose either. The intention is you'll be able to see how many followers you have. You'll be able to see how many likes you have on specific posts. But nobody else will, which is
I heard crazy. About that. I don't see the benefit.
I can't see the logic, no.
There's definitely a meritocracy would be the right word? I mean, there is a meritocracy. There's like a, you know, the whole idea of followers and likes does translate into, you know, either business or whatever. And I would think that that's the incentive to be on Instagram. So you're kind of taking, I mean, no one really gives a shit about your fucking sandwich that you take a picture of. Honestly. I mean, if I got to see your turkey sandwich, I mean, seriously.
It's social proofing, isn't it? And social proofing is a currency these days. You know, you see people, they'll grab a celebrity and they'll take a picture of them. That's a certain currency for them. And the more, you know, the likes you get, the higher your follower count, it is a social currency. And to remove that, I think they're forgetting what they're all about. That's all they're about.
It's so strange. And I hate to say the word influencer, but I was at an event last year. It was a Johnny Walker event, and my friend was the chef doing a pop-up. And it was a small invitation. There was like probably like 100 people in there. And there was one table of these people who we were told were influencers. They were specifically asked to sit at the table, have a nice meal, and all they were doing was taking pictures of each course. And then they were sending it off to all their followers, you know. And then all of a sudden, I kind of looked at it. We were looking in to see what they, this woman here, all she does is go take pictures of, she gets invited to restaurants, she takes pictures of the food, she sends it out to her 150,000 followers, and she just eats all over New York for free. And it is a fascinating thing that I would just don't see the benefit of. I don't see the benefit of taking away people's incentive to post.
Yeah,
you know?
It is strange. But I don't know whether it's a regulatory thing in certain countries or not. I'm not sure. But yeah, I find it very strange.
Wow. Look.
Let's move on. Let's talk about one of our sponsors. So Combat Abrasives, they've been with us for some time now. I use the belts, Jeff used the belts. Marek, I think everybody uses Combat Abrasives, but not everybody knows that they can get a discount. So if they go to combatabrasives.com and they use KnifeTalk10, they're going to get 10% off. And remember, they do abrasives, obviously belts in any, they'll even make up a belt in a specific size for you if you need, because they do it all in-house. It's a family-run business. They'll do it all in-house. They do epoxies. They do handle material. They do everything now. So go and take a look at Combat Abrasives at combatabrasives.com. Remember to tag us if you're going to use the promo code, because we'll share it out and everybody else gets to see the beautiful things that you've bought and everybody's happy.
Boom. Love it.
Hey, man, can I ask you a question?
All right. Hey, man, can I ask you a question is the segment where if you're on Instagram, you follow us at Knife Talk Podcast. Halfway through the week, we usually say, hey, DM us your questions and to participate in the show. So these are questions you have for us. And in the future, you can ask us anything. I mean, some of the questions we do over and over again, but, you know, we try to weed through them and help you out. So the first question comes from Chopping with Chris. If cost and availability was not prohibitive, what materials and steel would make the ultimate knife for you? So money's out the door. Money's out the door. You can make your shit out of whatever you want.
That's a strange one, that, because materials generally aren't, you know, a big cost when you're making a knife. Your cost is your time.
That's part of the materials too, then.
No, I suppose. I think I haven't used Dharma steel, and simply because that is a little bit more expensive than what I'm currently using. So right. I'd like to try that, because I don't make my own Damascus, I don't forge, so it would be nice to sort of experiment with some Dharma steel. But no, I'm quite happy with what I use, but, you know, making a change to a different steel isn't particularly expensive.
Well, obviously the most important, most expensive part of the knife, just for basic materials, is usually the handle material.
Yeah, yeah.
What would you putz around with?
You know, natural materials such as wood and so on. And, you know, some of that, desert ironwood and so on can be super expensive. But I just like interesting stuff. So, as I said, I'm currently working with a lot of recycled materials as well. I don't know. I wouldn't want to be known for just working with one material, because, you know, you're setting your style in stone then.
Right.
And talking about stone, yesterday at this knife show, there's lots of people making stone scales. So they're using granite and things like that. It's the scales of their knife.
Huh.
I wonder how that would hold up if it was dropped.
Well, I actually...
super brittle.
I actually just got some of that I guess it's made turquoise. I guess they grind up turquoise.
Oh, yes, I know the bluey-green stuff, yeah.
Yeah, and then they make it, it looks like, I don't know how they do it, but it definitely looks like turquoise. Hmm. And a lot of guys use it for spacers. I know John Phillips uses it for spacers a lot, and there's a lot of people. And I got a piece of it, and it's very interesting. But, you know, the funny thing is you were talking about the handle materials. When I was at the Blade Show last year, I was walking around with Will Stelter, and we were having a good time. We were talking, and we walked past a guy who was selling mammoth tooth. Mammoth tooth, and he had, I mean, the table looked like it was, you know, it was these brown teeth and brown tusks, and I guess they were using, I guess now the thing is with ivory, a lot of times they're using walrus ivory. Obviously, I don't think you can sell elephant ivory.
Yeah.
Easily, but there were all these brown mammoth tusks that were found, and Will was picking them up, and oh, but was this, what is this one? This, you know, it was a block that was like the size of like a shoebox, and it was like $1,500, and it was like insane. And I know that Josh Scott uses mammoth tooth a lot, and I just it is fascinating that people are using these found weird bones from prehistoric animals to make handles.
Yeah. But I think particularly the hunting guys making, you know, hunting knives, they love all that kind of stuff, and, you know, pine cones set in resin, all that kind of stuff.
I think that if I like the question, because I've just recently started making Damascus here. When Cliff Dufton was up here, we set the weld for tube Damascus billets, and I'm going to slowly forge them out, and just based on the time, I don't have a whole lot of time, so I'm trying to carve out a little bit of time to do. I want to do more if I could make Damascus, I would probably do all Damascus. I just, at first I was like, this stuff, who cares? It's a little fooling around. But all of a sudden, you're just like, when you start to make it and it works, you're like, you know what? This is fucking cool, and I'm kind of on board, because it's like it's working, and it's fascinating, and you do get this kind of idea of how to kind of work smarter, and it's for me. I would like to make more Damascus. If I could make more Damascus, I'd make more Damascus. In regards to wood, I like the burl. I hate to say it, because I do so much with like the G10, but some of these burls are awesome. I got this one burl from these Australians. It was like one of these weird seed pods. It was this pod that I don't even know the name of it. Some weird Australian pod that the guy said that, you know, it goes through a forest fire and that kind of like cures it or something like that. It's this strange alien pod. And it's, I forgot the goddamn name. It's just some bullshit name. Who knows? With these Australians, you know, God bless you. But this weird pod, I'd use that pod. It's so bizarre looking. It's kind of like a pine cone, but it's got all sorts of weird holes and stuff like that.
They normally like set in resin.
Yeah, I know what you mean.
I know what you mean. Yeah,
I think I might have paid too much for one of them. When I emptied my bag, I was like, I gotta have this pod, this strange Australian pod. And I'm looking at it, and I put my measuring tape on it, and I'm like, I can only get one knife out of this motherfucker. I think I got stupid. So I would do Damascus with weird Australian pods. There you go. Nice.
Eric Markman, he asks, he's got question stroke beef. Why is it that when people send you a DM about how to do something or what to use, and it gives them a serious answer, they don't even have the dignity to say a thank you? It happens a lot. Tell me about it. Every week. And people expect you to just stop what you're doing, answer their questions, and then they just fuck off. There's no thank you. There's nothing.
I love it. You know what? Eric Markman's awesome. He's such a good dude. I've met him at the Blade Show, and he's such a talented guy. He's going to be my community showcase. He's a fan of the podcast. He also sent me a message saying, if you need more beefs, I got a lot of them. He angry on the Netherlands. So, people are the worst. I mean, I think that dealing with people not face to face makes you such a piece. It makes you so shittier. Makes you so shittier. People ask us questions. Oh yeah, like all the times people say, "Can you do a video step by step I like the ones where people say, can you do a video step by step on how you make a knife? Thanks in advance. As in, I've already said I'm going to do it. Thanks in advance. Because I know you're going to do it. These people are crazy. Yeah. And I think that if you dealt with these people face to face, obviously I think people are more polite.
I think people have got nothing to lose on, you know, on social media. They'll ask you something. They know they've got nothing to lose. If you don't respond, fair enough. If you do, it's a win. But yeah, but that whole not even saying thank you, you know, it's just, oh, come on.
Well, the funny thing is we're creating this relationship where we're trying to be helpful. Like when people send me DMs, I mean, unless it's a hey cutie hot stuff, I usually answer them, and I try to be as helpful as I can within reason. I mean, some people are just getting so goddamn lazy. It's like, where do I, you know, the one thing I get all the time is, where do I find an epoxy dye? You know, when I dye my knives, the file work, I use a dye. And that's like maybe the number one question I get is, where do you get the dye? There are knife supply stores. You can look it up. I mean, those are the questions that are easy. Some people are just like, we are getting more and more brain dead. Did you hear that there's a strange evolution in the human skeleton where we're starting to grow horns out of the back of our head?
What?
I'm telling you, we're getting in the
For
back of our
head. For what purpose?
Because we're leaning down. It's like a bone spur in your skull.
Because we're on our phones head down.
My daughter's on the phone a lot. And I'm starting to notice that there's like her neck is like arcing a little bit. And I'm just like, yo, you stand the fuck, you get that phone out of your hand. Stand up. Yeah, stand up straight. But I'm telling you, we're getting stupider and stupider.
Jeez, horns. That is.
Yeah. Horns at the back of your head. I mean, there's that whole theory of why the fuck are we wearing, you know, we have back pain because we're putting so much stuffing in our shoes. There's so much padding. We never needed that shit before. Now all of a sudden we're having these terrible back pains because now we're obsessed with these Nike Air shoes with the special shit on it. I gotta be careful the kind of shoes I wear because we're evolving into awfulness. That's what's happening. We're losing our sense of society. We're losing our sense of civility. We're fucking up our bodies with the dumbest things of imaginable. We're getting reverse muscles.
We're just retraining our body for a new future.
Yeah, but the dumbest future.
Yeah. I've got this phrase that, and we're actually having a sign made for the house at the top of the stairs. So when we come down each morning, the first thing you see is what if everybody did it? And I remember even as a kid, I used to think that all the time. You know, if you drop a piece of litter, what if everybody did it? We'd be in the shit. If you were to pick up a piece of litter on the floor, what if everybody did it? The world would be a much better place. But yet we're getting to that point where nobody gives a shit about anybody else. It's all about them. So they want answers to questions. They're not thanking anyone. They, you know, it's a strange time to be alive.
It's a great time to be alive because obviously we're the top of the food chain on Earth. But it's like it's the nonsense we get stuck on. It's like it is stunning. So Eric. I think you're too helpful. I think that's what it comes down to. I think Eric's too helpful. You need to like not be so helpful to people because ultimately that's what happens. I get people who send me messages and they ask for help and then they're like, well, what about this? Well, what about that? And they don't answer the question. You're just like, well, that wasn't, you know, then all of a sudden I'm being an asshole for not helping.
Yeah.
Mareko gets it all the time. All the time. He's the most helpful guy in the world. He's helpful to the point where he's showing people how you make the steel he makes. And then they're like, can you think you could write it down? Or do you think you could send me a video? Maybe if you just did a video, it would help me out more. It's like, how much more helpful can you be?
Crazy. He did show me one of the DMs he had this week. I think you've seen it as well.
Yeah.
People are just crazy.
I gotta tell you, I do like it when he sends me some of the DMs he gets. It is pretty funny. He doesn't take it very well, and I wouldn't either. It's just I don't either. It's frustrating. It's super frustrating because you're listening to, when you're dealing with a phone or you're dealing with a computer, you're getting the uncontrolled id. You're not getting like, let's be, you know, you're getting this, you know, your deepest, darkest thoughts that are not vetted or edited. Mm-hmm. So it's like these crazy, you're asking people, you're saying things that you're not even thinking, well, how is this person going to respond? I don't know. It's not a person. It's a screen. There you go, Eric. Jesus Christ.
This is like an episode of Beefs.
I know. I love it. I love it. We got to do that again. All right. This one comes from Michael J. Budd. Hey, fellas, can I ask you a question? By the way, Michael J. Budd is an awesome blacksmith. I think he's in the UK. Hey, fellas, can I ask you a question? I have an order to make tools for a basket weaver. Among the tools is a hook knife with a cutting edge on the inside of the hook. Any tips on grinding a blade like this?
Ooh.
And guess what?
Never done one.
Guess what? Guess what? I also like this question so much that I did a little bit of research, and one of the people I asked was one of the just an incredible bladesmith. I learned about him a while ago. His name is, let me just pop it up here. God damn it, I lost it. It was from, oh my God, I can't believe it. I threw it away. Oh, do I have it right here? I got it. Oh, phew. Reed Schwartz. Now, Reed Schwartz is, he makes these incredible forge carving knives, spoon knives. He makes these, it's called a Sloyd knife, I think, that where it's a thin knife that has a very a robust handle. And they're all forged. He does a beautiful job. And I actually reached out to him because this is kind of what he does. And this is what he said in regards to, so basically the question is I don't know if you've seen those spoon carving knives, those hook knives. How do you grind the inside of the knife? If you're not doing both sides, you're going to do both sides. How do you grind the inside of the knife? How do you get in there? And this is what he said. If the curve is open enough, you just want to get in there with a small contact wheel. Chances are the type of knife we're talking about is a question mark shape with a closed curve. So access to the inside of the curve is a challenge. The asker probably needs to step away from a stationary grinder, clamp the blade in a vise, and go at it with a die grinder. I have one set up with the adjustable speeds and small friable grinding stones so you can get the burr up, and then you go in with your hand grit finishes. And there you are. Mm-hmm. Reed is he was my community showcase a few months ago. He's an incredible bladesmith, and he makes, carving knives, and that's one of those things. And that's the best way to go. So what he was saying is to tie it onto a vise and then go in there with your Dremel, your and then bring that burr up and kind of go into it.
Mm. The only way I was thinking a possible way of doing it is maybe use a small contact wheel and get in it that way. But, you'd need to be a fairly fair-sized blade to be able to do that, I think. Never given that a thought before. Never before.
No, well, there actually is there's another thing that he mentioned it's a technique that somebody he knows does where you're actually forging in the hollow. Before you're forging in the hollow before you bend it over, and it's one of those things. It's like he made the point, and I'm being very loosey goosey to it because he was basically saying this is somebody who's specifically figured it out, and a lot of people are ripping him off. So without trying to be loosey goosey and vague, there are other ways to do it, but it's just a question of you want to be the guy who's doing other people's techniques and stuff.
Okay, CM_knives asks, hey man, can I ask you a question? Do you guys have any tips for getting J-hooks out of plunge lines? And Jeff, I know you do because I copy the same way you do it.
Well, I mean, a J-hook, and a lot of people, when I'm teaching people how to, I had to figure out a way to hand sand so it was understandable right off the bat, because a lot of times hand sanding in general is just so like, am I done? You don't even know. So the J-hook comes from when you're putting your pad. Let's just say you're making a pad, when you come towards yourself with the pad and then you head back. So what happens is you move slightly and then you make this hesitation mark that comes from the back of the pad, and you make like little U's. So the most important thing is going back and forth all the time is what makes the J hooks. So if you were to start your pad at the plunge line and then come up and out, and when you don't head back on the knife, you kind of lift it up at the end. The other thing is what happens with J-hooks is if, let's say your sanding stick is 2 inches by like an inch and a half from the front to the back. If you put the pad down flat, the back of the pad is what's going to give you J-hooks as well. So sometimes what you're going to want to do is you're going to want to stick that pad or whatever your sanding stick is and almost lift the back up and then just do kind of clean pulls. And what that'll do is that'll take away that hesitation mark because there's no way for you to go back. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
But that's a big thing. Like if you have your sanding stick flat when you put your sanding stick flat on the blade, the end closest towards you is going to create a J-hook automatically.
I think he's asking specifically about plunge lines. So I normally don't have a plunge line. My chef knives, the transition is sort of tapered. But my last big order, about 3-4 weeks ago, of steak knives, they wanted a plunge line. So the way I did that is I copied you. You did it in a video where I used like a wallpaper scraper. And I put the sandpaper around that so you can get right into that hard edge.
Yeah. So basically it took I was getting so irritated because if the front end of a sanding stick is flat, you get the top of it always kind of knocks before you get in there. So what I started to do is I took a spackle knives or a spatula, and then I would wrap the paper around that. And then you have a very, very fine, edge. And then also it's got that flexibility so you can really kind of get a little bit more torque and then you can get in there. And then sometimes I put some rubber on some, and it is a good, the most important thing is to get in and then do a nice pull and then you pull out. Don't stay on the blade. You have to almost like do a swiping up towards you movement. I don't know if that was helpful or not. Are we ready to continue?
Let's do another one.
All right. This comes from CN Knives. Hey, you dirty dogs. Let me ask you a question. How do you cope with self-doubt and getting stuck in a rut? What are some ways you use to check yourself and get back on your game when you're feeling down and almost feel like quitting? Asking for a friend.
Man, I'm in that situation once every few months.
Yeah.
And it's horrible because it just feels as if, like, what the hell am I doing here? What, you know, if maybe you're not enjoying it, whatever reason it may be. But there's no real answer. You just need to suck it up. I mean, what helps me is having sort of a day off of something. Try something that you've never done before. Learn something new. So maybe you've never done a chef knife before, or maybe you've never done a hunting knife before. Just take the time and do it slowly. Take your time and learn something new. Quite often that'll sort of rekindle the whole reason you started doing this in the first place.
It's super tough. It's super tough because I can get blue. Like my wife knows when I'm heading down like a bad road, and she kind of like almost feels it coming on. This week when I was grinding 50 knives all day for 2 days straight, it was like, it was mentally numbing. And then I would just be like, when is this going to be done? And all of a sudden you're just not focused and you can go down this depressing route easy. Or if you're not organized, or if you don't show up, if you don't, I talk about this only because, you know, and you guys are all nice in regards to how I'm very organized. If I didn't come into the shop organized, my day is a fucking wreck. Like I literally have to, in my mind, I have to really visualize and like pump into myself exactly what I need to get done for the day. Because if I show up and I kind of deviate, I can be like, what am I doing? I shouldn't be doing this now. Or I didn't get these things done. And you start to feel bad about yourself. And then all of a sudden you kind of spiral out of control. Your mind is just, it's not, sometimes it's not good. It's not good to be free thinking sometimes. Sometimes if I just walk in here with no plan, I can spiral into depression quick. You know, and what am I doing? Or this isn't working. Or this is, you got to be like as organized as possible because then you get that satisfaction and you feel good about yourself when you got all those things done. And it's this realization like, hey, I'm not playing around, or I'm not convincing someone that I'm doing something that I'm not.
Yeah. And I find rewarded myself as well. So let's say I need to grind 50 blades out. I'll say, well, if I can get this done by, for example, 2 p.m. tomorrow, I'll then head off to the beach and spend some time. And, you know, and so you're giving yourself a reason to get through the thing that you don't want to be doing because you've got a reward afterwards.
That's the hardest part about working for yourself is saying this. I'm not playing in my shop. I'm not fooling around. This is a job. This is work. This is how I'm going to succeed. And if without it sucks, man. I feel for this guy because I can go down this quickly. I can go down this route quickly, and I just have to like occupy my time with being organized and being like, this is what I have to get done today. This is what I have to get done before lunch. This is what I have to get done by the end of the day. This is what I have to get done by the end of the week. This is what I have to get done by the end of the month. Otherwise, you know, I'm just going to fool around.
And I think we can all sort of slide down very quickly as well.
So fast!
And particularly, we're looking, I mean, we've mentioned Instagram a few times, but, you know, for us knife makers, it's a big tool. But we're seeing people's highlights reel, remember? So everybody there you're looking at, they're going to have their days as well. It's not all high fives and hand jobs.
I really hope that my expression of it's not all high fives and hand high fives and lightning bolts doesn't get replaced with high fives and hand jobs. Because now it just sounds like that's what... God damn you, Lockwood. You screwed me on a perfectly good line. Now everyone's going to be saying, I know what Fader says. Fader doesn't say that. Craig says that. Hand jobs. Who wants a hand job anyway?
I think we've covered that. It's everybody gets it, and you need to find a way.
It sucks.
Everybody's different, but... Yeah, work through it, and, you know, it's temporary.
And the other thing is the kind of people who work by themselves for a reason. We're not like, you know, we all have this vision of happiness and of all this stuff we want to get done, but we like being solitary. And it's sometimes when you're super solitary, if you don't have a game plan, it happens. We said covered it. Just get yourself some work done. Come on, man.
Alex_Loney asks, hey, man, can I ask you a question? Just bought himself a new 2x72 grinder and he needs a motor. And he's wondering, will he be able to get by with the 1 horsepower or does he need more? And he's asking if a VFD is worth it for someone who has little money. What do you think?
It's super hard to suggest, yes, it's worth it. You're talking super hard when I have two motors that are about to be, you know, shit the bed, and I'm going to just replace one of them. And I'm like waiting. I'm waiting for, I am cheap and stupid. If I could do it all over again, I would have gotten all VFDs. I love them. But I don't know what the fuck is wrong with my head. I just can't get a hold of it. One horsepower is great. I think 3/4 horsepower is fine too. Get yourself, you know, and there are people who sell reconditioned motors. With motors, it's like you want to buy one, you want to get something good. Get something good, and you know, no one ever says I shouldn't have got that. I have only one piece of equipment I wish I shouldn't have, I should have got, but I don't want to say it. One of your old sponsors, I wish I had got.
I know who you're talking about. I use mine all the time. I love it.
I wish I had got that, but that's fine. Old sponsor.
Old sponsor, yeah. But no, I mean, I think 1 horsepower, I mean, mine is a 1 horsepower, the two machines I've got, and they've never stalled out on me. It's more than enough power. I've got one with the VFD and one without. The one with the VFD is now my go-to for everything. The other one just basically sits out the most. It's a big paperweight. But I know what it's like. You know, if you've got a little money and you're deciding, at the end of the day, you need a grinder. You get that grinder up and going. I'm not sure whether you can retrofit a VFD to all motors. I'm not sure.
No idea.
Maybe that's something worth looking at. Maybe you can buy a motor and use that for now, then later stick a VFD on that same motor. I'm not sure. I'm sure some of our listeners will know. So if you know, let us know. Stick it up on a story or reply to us, and we'll share it to Alec.
But, you know, no one ever says, you know, when they're upgrading to a grinder, no one ever says, I wish I'd never got that 2x72 grinder. Nobody. Yeah. Nobody. Yeah. They're like, why did I wait so long? Why did I wait so long is always the question.
Okay, should we move to another one?
Yeah.
Go on then.
Oh, it's me. Oh, sorry. Don't edit that. I didn't realize. Go on then. All right. This comes from Mr. Big Jeep. Question for someone who grew up in the wine and food industry. we as an industry build our reputation on constructive criticism. I'm still laughing from going on then. We as an industry build our reputation on constructive criticism. Do knife makers like it? Like to hear from their customers? Let's say I get a knife from a well-established journeyman smith and the grinds are off. Am I a dick to point them out?
Not at all. If you're not happy with something, and I'm sure the maker would want to know as well if something's not, if you're not 100% happy with it, they'd want to know.
Yeah.
But yeah, it's, as a maker, it's horrible when you get those emails, because I've had one or two over the years. It's horrible, but it certainly makes me a better maker, because I'll make damn sure that, you know, that mistake isn't happening again.
Exactly.
And it could be an oversight that, you know, that they're not aware of even. Who knows?
You know what? I actually have changed. Back in the day, my knives used to be super, super thick. And I would get people saying, I'm not used to something like this, or this isn't really cutting the way I expected to. I made adjustments in my design based on criticism. If everyone loves your knives all the time, you think, all right, well, I don't have anything to change. But if you start to get like, all right, well, this is something that bothers me, or like I made a knife a long time ago for a friend of mine, and he was like, you know, it kind of hurts my finger going against the heel, the choil. He didn't say the choil, obviously didn't know what that word was. He's like, can you round it? I was like, oh, I never even thought about that a long time ago. And then based on his criticism, well, not criticism, it was a suggestion, I changed the way I do all the choils of my knife. So you end up learning. It sucks to get criticism. It sucks for someone. It sucks when somebody says something. You don't want, you get that pit in your stomach where you're just like, oh God, I fucked up, or I'm useless, or I'm the worst person in the world, or I'm garbage. This sucks. I don't know why I did this anymore. Why do I wake up in the morning, you know, hand jobs and high fives, you know, but it does make you better. It does make you better, because all of a sudden you're just like, well, I don't want this shit to happen again. Constructive criticism is good. And the funny thing is, I don't look for it. Like I have some sort of like, I when I was walking around, like I said, at the Blade Show, all these people bring their knives to be critiqued. And in my mind, I'm thinking, what the fuck do you care what these people have to say? And it was really like, it was like they were getting a lot of people get a lot of information from other knife makers on how they make their knives and things that they could point out. And it's helpful. But I think I'm too fragile. I think I have too fragile of an ego. I think I've been critiqued as an artist so long that I've had it, that I'm just not willing to like let myself accept, you know, criticism.
Yeah. I'd say, I mean, yeah, point out if you think it's a mistake or if you think it could be improved upon, point it out, but do it in a respectful way. There's no need to, you know, to go at this guy. Just say, you know.
And it's also based on price.
Yeah, exactly.
You know, $1,000 knives get $1,000 problems, you know. Yeah. And I think that, you know, it's based on, you know, if you know, I think a lot of times if you have a knife that's inexpensive, usually people overlook certain things. Not that that's good or bad. It's just, you know, it's not really just on the...
Let them know. Just be nice. I think it's simple as that, really.
But just don't be a dick about it. I mean, I think what he says, am I a dick to point it out? Why? You know, conversation is a combination lock. And you open that combination if you have the right, you know, you get it across what you want if you have the right combination. So just don't call someone, you know, just don't write something kind of asshole-y. There's a lot of people who have the... They're not very adept at the art of conversation, so they sound like an asshole. And when you read an email, you read it like they're being the worst asshole possible. So I think that you need to kind of spoonful of sugar this shit. You know, just give them a little bit of, hey man, hope you're well. Hope the family's well. Thanks again. By the way, this knife sucks. You don't do it like that. You know,
shit sandwich, isn't it? So you start with a compliment, then give him the shit, then end with a compliment.
Yeah, that's also referred to as the smack and tickle. You know about the smack and tickle?
No.
That's what you do. We used to call it the smack and tickle, because what you would do is you'd say something harsh and then follow it up with something, you know, you break them down and then you build them back up. So I used to love the smack and tickle, because I would say something super harsh and then I'd be like, hey, you know what though? You did a great job here or there, the other thing. And I like the smack and tickle. It is very, it is an aggressive form of communication, because you're putting someone, it's like sucker punching someone and then giving them like a little kiss. It's really it isn't right, really. The smack and tickle is brutal. I grew up with the smack and tickle. All right, so here we are. Let's talk about our next sponsor, our new sponsor, awesome sponsor, Indasa USA. Indasa USA are the people who make RhinoWet, and they are, it's, I'm telling you, I learned about RhinoWet when I was watching Nick Wheeler videos, and he was talking about RhinoWet, and I'd never seen it in the stores. RhinoWet is by far a much better abrasive sandpaper for whatever. I usually buy sheets that I use for hand sanding, but I also have sheets that I use for the disc sander. And what you can do is you can actually cut the excess off and use the excess for hand sanding. I love RhinoWet. I've been pushing RhinoWet. Everybody who uses RhinoWet realizes that it is a superior abrasive to the stuff that you're buying.
It's a time saver. Massive time
saver. Super time saver. It's super aggressive. I don't know how they figured it out, but Indasa USA does a great job. And now you're starting to see more companies stocking RhinoWet, including our sponsor, Texas Farrier Supply. Texas Farrier Supply have been on board with us for a long time. They've been a super good, super bunch. We've been kind of back and forth with them for a while. They listen to the podcast, and they are going to save you 10% off on your RhinoWet by putting in Knife Talk 10 when you're buying from Texas Farrier Supply. Is that just RhinoWet?
Well, it's a dirty little secret that if you use Knife Talk 10, you'll actually get 10% off all their products.
All right, so go to Texas Farrier Supply and get yourself some RhinoWet. Look at all the other stuff they have. They just posted to anvils and stuff like that. They have all sorts of great stuff. Knife supply stuff, blacksmithing stuff, farrier supply stuff. And then you put Knife Talk 10 and you get 10% off. So thank you, Indasa USA. Thank you, Texas Farrier Supply. Get your RhinoWet. Boom. There we are.
There we go. Let's get on with another question. So this one is from E.G. Bert Joe.
That's Egbert. what E.G. Bert? It's Egbert.
Egbert with one G. Egbert Joe.
That's a great name, Egbert Joe.
Hello, men.
Before you started, there's a kid who, the time you weren't on, we had a message from a guy named Caleb, and Mareko called him KLB. And I said, it's not KLB, it's Caleb. So now I get messages from Caleb, and I always call him KLB now. It's such a better name. So Egbert Joe, we're with you. You and KLB got to get together.
Hello, men. I'm a new blacksmith, and I've worked on a few knives. I've got a number and letter stamp set to do initials and dates on his work. But he's having a hard time being consistent on the spacing and lining them up straight. Do you have any tips on how to do this better?
These stamps are awful. And one of the main reasons why is when they make these stamps, and usually letter stamps are on the cheap side, and I know you, Egbert Joe, you're probably buying the cheapest set possible. They're not 100%, sometimes they're not 100% square on the stamp. So like the L could be off a hair. So a lot of times that happens. What I used to do, and I hate it when people want their initials on the knife. It drives me fucking crazy. I hate it. It's like, it's not your fucking knife. You didn't make this knife. All right, you need your initials on it, like a monogram? Come on. So I used to do the stamps, and then what I would do was I would actually have a piece of wood next to the stamps, and then I would kind of like do a practice hit to see how it lined up, and I would know that if it was off, you know, like clockwise 15 degrees or whatever degrees, I would just kind of like compensate. I usually do like I don't do a scribe line. I'll do like a Sharpie line, and then I'll just practice. But the wood allows me to kind of embed the print, the stamp on the wood, and I can see where the stamp is oriented on the stamp. It sucks. And you have to like make the point where it's just like, well, that's the hand part of it. It's this, you know, it's supposed to look a little bit shitty.
Yeah. I don't know. I've never done it, but could you, let's say the letters or the initials, or whatever, are quite small. Could you tape a bunch of the stamps together?
They're
and do
actually
that initial hit, and then from then on you can do them individually to get
well,
deeper hit.
Here's the problem with all those. If you're doing it cold and hot are totally different. You can get I've seen this company, they sell like a little like a rack that you can kind of slide them all together. The problem is one of usually with those stamps is the spacing's weird. So like they're not really meant to be you know, side by side. There's almost the spacing is a little bit strange.
The kerning of the letters,
Right. It's not really optimal. I think that you got to practice. I think that's the hardest part. The spacing's weird. I know that a lot of people do them. And the other thing is with the stamps are sometimes the way they make the stamps, depending on how you're driving them in, there's too much. There's not. They're not high enough off the stamp itself. So what I do is for my my touch mark, I had to grind away or chase away a lot of the excess material. So when I was grinding it, I would get the Superman symbol on my or whatever I would stamp because I'd stamp it so hard, I would go all the way down to the bottom of the indentation, and I would get the seal too. So I don't like stamping at all. It's just too. And then the other thing is if you don't have it held nicely, it shoots out of your whatever you're holding it on. And if I've blown through two windows with a goddamn letter E, Egbert, it's the worst. I hate stamping. I hate it.
E.G. Bert Joe.
Egbert. It sucks. And the other thing is if you try to do a light tap and then a hard tap, if it doesn't feel like it's sitting in there really, really good, you get that hologram, that double tap, and then you've ruined it. The double tap is the worst if you don't have it 100% right. So I say get electro etching, get an electro etch, or get a laser gun or a laser printer, whatever the hell that thing is. Egbert. All right. This next one comes from Dave Irving _ Evader Knives. Better. How can we pull together as a community to push that knives aren't weapons? Just a small part. Everyone uses Everyone uses knives every day, and it's not just for food. So how are we going to? This is the question of questions right here.
It's this thing, isn't it? It's the media at the moment. They're only demonizing knives because there's a culture of a very, very small, minute part of these communities out there that are using knives for violence and all the rest of it. But it's such a minute part.
Yeah, but I mean,
what can you do? There's just so few people doing that. But if you listen to the press, you'd think that everybody's up to it.
Yeah, but people have been cutting people for fucking millions of years.
Yeah.
As soon as a knife was made, somebody got speared or somebody got cut up. You know, this is like the oldest story in the book. I mean, unfortunately, people are going to figure out ways to hurt each other. Whether it's a knife or, and the other thing is, you know, knives are intimidating. They're intimidating objects. You know, you never hear someone get stuck up with a dildo. You know, people don't get, no one's ever been involved in dildo crime. You know, there's no, I mean, seriously, go find me an article about somebody got robbed with a fucking dong.
You know, I'm going to Google that. It's going to be
one. You better. It's not going to happen.
You keep talking. I'm going to find
it. It's not going to happen. These are objects people realize are perfectly good for it's not just the physical intimidation, but it's the terror of the mental intimidation.
Here we go. I found
get
two.
Get the fuck out of here. You didn't find two. Go ahead.
A guy in Pittsburgh robbed a bank with a vibrator.
Get that's the fuck on, out of here. Is that true? Vice. Was it like, but he pulled it out? Or was it like in his pocket?
35-year-old Aaron Stein was arrested on Monday after robbing a PNC bank in the Pittsburgh with a sex toy. The next one is woman fights off armed robber with a dildo at a sex shop.
Well, that's what, you know what that is. I mean, that's self-defense right there. That's a heroic story. A heroic story.
Fought off the armed robber by throwing dildos at him.
Hey, listen. That's the way to go, but that is a story of heroism. That's a story of defending your property with dildos. I'm talking about there are no dildo stick up jobs. There aren't. You're never gonna find. Maybe the guy with the vibrator tried to rob that bank. I got a feeling he didn't pull it out. He didn't pull that dick out to rob the bank.
You'd have to have batteries with you. You'd have to be charged up all the time. It's
well,
too
you
much,
probably
too
do
much
that thing
hassle.
Where you, where you make the finger gun and then you stick it in your pocket and you make it look like you're don't move.
This is a stick up.
Nobody move. Nobody move. I gotta no. That didn't happen. No. Listen. Ultimately, what's got to happen is it's got people who make knives have got to say, all right, listen, these are for these. This is what I make these for. And you have to, you know, there should be, instead of worrying about, you know, legislature, you know, stopping the sale of things, you have to try to tell people, look, this isn't for intimidating people, or I don't want you to do this, or I don't know what the answer is. I mean, you definitely have there's a different opinion about people who have chef knives versus people who have, you know, EDC or whatever. I don't know what the answer is. It sucks. It sucks for a lot of people who are trying to do good things. Yeah. You know, I do remember that my I think my sister was asking me. I was going to California with some for a thing, and I brought the knives with me. And they said, "Did they let you? How did you get on the plane?" I'm like, "Well, I put them under the plane. I checked them." And they said, "Why is that? How is that legal?" I'm like, "What are you talking about? You got to cook something. You got to cook with something." And I didn't put it in my pocket. I put it under the plane. And it was just this, she had this opinion about about, you know, what the knife was going to be used for. I'm like, for fucking cutting onions, you know?
That's the thing. If you check in on a plane, you don't have access to it. It's perfectly
but
safe.
I think that, you know, I also have another family relative who, when they see one of my knives, they say, that's a killer thing right there. It's a killer thing, as in, like, it's vicious looking. And I'm like, you got to cut your crust off your sandwiches somehow. I think that there's this mental, I think we should just start, you know, I think the key are limp dicks. You got to make some limp dick knives, you know, and you got to make some, or pickles, make your knives look like, the handles look like pickles or limp dicks. And maybe you'll change people's opinion.
I think we're, at the moment, it's hot in the media. And I think in 6 months' time, there'll be something hot in the media and people will move on.
Yeah. Tennis rackets.
Yeah.
We got to outlaw tennis rackets.
Dangerous tennis rackets, yeah.
Well, clearly, people are, when a victim will be more intimidated by an object that's used in violence versus something that won't be used. No one's going to rob you with a pillow. No one's going to rob you with a, you don't get nervous if someone's holding a broomstick. You know, there is a connotation for centuries and centuries and centuries and centuries of knives and swords being used for violence. And you're never going to, it's like, you're never going to be not afraid of monsters. I don't know where I get with that. I say we go back to the dildos. Start making dildos.
Let's do one more each. So all right. I'll take one here from Handsome Mick. Hey, you cuties. It's your boy from Canada again. He says his shop is almost done. Just need to run the electrical bits. The question is, there are no schools near me. Is there an online program you would recommend, or should I just suck it up and travel to a school? He's having a hard time with his decision, as he's just a weekend warrior stage in the craft. Cheers, guys.
It sucks.
What do you
man.
Think? So he's got nowhere locally where he can go to learn. He's wondering if there's anywhere online where he can take a good course.
Well, there. You know, it's interesting because, you know, there is a need. There's a need. And there's obviously places like the New England School of Metalwork, the Center for Metal Arts, but there's not like places you can go. I know that Robert Labash out in Arizona has a lot of classes. I might be doing something with him pretty soon. It's hard. It's fucking hard. And now there's, I know guys, friends of ours, Noah Vachon is starting to get ready to teach some classes. He did some, you know, some weekend classes to kind of get people, you know, to fool around. He did a nice job. His team did a nice job. It's hard. And you want to say go to schools. You want to say don't learn everything on the internet. But if you're away from if you're nowhere near anybody, it's easier said than done. You know, I think that,
and I suppose there's no substitute for, you know, being with somebody in the room.
No,
you know,
there is
online,
no substitute.
You're going to learn a bit, but it won't be the same.
I've said the same thing a million times. Forging is one of those things you can't learn by, and until you actually feel how the metal moves under the hammer, you have no idea. All of a sudden, you're just like, wow, this wasn't anything like I thought it was going to be. I thought it was going to be like hitting a piece of bubble gum. It's not like that at all. I think that, especially in Canada, I think you need to use the, you know, you need to search the internet for something close by. I do believe taking a class at New England School of Metalwork, taking a class at the Center for Metal Arts will propel you incredibly. Getting involved with the ABS, They do a lot of they sell a lot of DVDs, the greatest DVDs. But other than that, they're very they're helpful. I know Jay Nielsen does a set of DVDs. They're supposed to be awesome. There's a lot of people out there trying to help fill that educational gap, and it's something going to have to happen. You know, I think it's worth it. I think taking a class is worth it. I've never taken a class I didn't think it was worth it. But you know, I hear you.
Okay.
Well, the next one is going to be from. Let's go with. This comes from Hosey Custom Knives. Hose Custom Knives. Hey, cuties, where do y'all like to travel that is not knife related, such as shows? Where do you go to relax with your family and friends? I take a week every summer and travel to Wyoming to visit friends and I fly fish.
Nice.
So where do you go to relax?
At the moment, I'm almost splitting my time between the UK and France, so it does feel as if I'm always traveling. But you know, we haven't really had a family holiday for 2 years. We went to Rhodes in Greece, which is a beautiful place.
Wow.
And hoping to go back again next year, actually. But travel is just part of my sort of everyday at the moment. So I'm not really taking time out to go traveling on holiday in as such.
Yeah. Well,
what about you?
Well, my wife and I, since we've been together, we always used to go down to the Virgin Islands. We used to go to St. John specifically. Mm. It's hard to get to because you have to fly into St. Thomas and then take a taxi to a ferry to get to St. John. It's St. John is like a lot of national park, and we're so stupid and cheap. We always go in the height of hurricane season. So we've gone about five times. We haven't gone in a few years. Life has been too hard lately to a trip like that. But we always get hit. It's beautiful, and it's not very touristy because it's so much national park. And what happens is we always go in the end of August, and we always get hit with a hurricane. Always. We get evacuated, and we're like, we're never going to do this again. Let's go back again. They're good cheap tickets now. It's off season. And then we get
the pain.
Here's what we did. We got hit with the hurricane two times, one year after the next. We stayed at the same place. And the second, they evacuated us the first year. And then the second year, the guy came up to me and says, we've never had to evacuate the same people 2 years in a row. So what we're going to do is we're just going to give you one of the main buildings, one of the main houses. We're going to screw you into there. So what do you mean screw us into there? We're gonna. They took plywood and they screwed all the windows shut while we were in there. Gave us a walkie talkie and some water, and we sat
Jesus,
through the hurricane.
Happy holidays.
Yeah, wow. And we're like, this is great. We don't have to. We can be evacuated. And we're like, this sucks. We're screwed into a building. So we used to. It wasn't very relaxing. That I must say. But
it reminds me of our honeymoon. So 5 years ago, when we got married, my wife and I, we went to the Amalfi Coast in Italy, to Sorrento. Beautiful place. Pompeii is there, and Mount Vesuvius, which is the big volcano. And you can do the walk up there, and there's these roads there that have been there for like 2,000 years, these old sort of dirt track that you can walk up. So we went up, and we're in, shorts, T-shirt, and I was wearing, like flip-flops, and, it was a boiling hot day. We got to the top, and this almighty storm came, and it's the worst they've had, and it was... Ice was falling down, and people were bleeding when the ice was hitting them. It was horrendous. It was like disaster zone. So these roads that have been there for 2,000 years, some of those just disappeared, and there was these like little lodges every now and again, every sort of few hundred meters, and people were just getting in there, rammed in, freezing cold, shaking. We got down to the bottom. They had to call the army out to remove trees and stuff so they can get up on the road to get us back down. So we get back down, and there's people being taken straight to hospital because they had all these horrible sores on their body from the ice and so on.
Oh my God.
It was crazy. So we spent the next 2 days of our honeymoon literally just in the hotel room, like, we're not going out. We're not going anywhere.
I'm imagining you slipping around on those flip-flops.
Oh, it was terrible.
Just
it
miserable.
Was, yeah.
Oh, yeah. Flip.
The only time I've genuinely feared for my life. And like I said, these roads have been there for 2,000 years and they just disappeared. It was just this freak storm.
Huh.
Yeah, so disasters on holidays. So, yeah,
there
I
you
know
go.
The feeling.
We're not doing a good job on where we should be relaxing.
No.
That's where we go. We're doing a terrible job on where we should be relaxing. And then they got stuck up with a guy with a dildo. Next thing you know.
Right, I am going to read one more question. Where is it? I just
yeah, go ahead. One. Go ahead.
Just a second.
I'm having a good time.
So here's a question from Gabe Jensen 09. What's the optimal thickness when it comes to chef knives? I'll kick off. I'll start with this because I used to be quite thick. I used to go for sort of 3.5 mil when I first started making knives.
Right.
And I think that was down to being nervous about using a much thinner stock. But I always knew it needed to be thinner. But all of my knives now, they're all using a 2.5 millimeter stock. So I don't know what that is in inches.
I don't have my make everything shop conversion thing, but yeah. I would imagine it's probably close to. I would imagine it's probably 3/32.
Right. Okay. But yeah, 2.5 mil. I use my chef knife, my steak knives are 2.5 mil as well. That's my sort of standard across the board now, unless somebody asks for something specifically thicker.
Well, it is interesting because I actually started to make. I started out my knives back in the day were like 3/16. They were thick as fuck, and it was like a ridiculous. And then I went to 1/8 for a long time, and now I've been doing 3/32 for all my chef knives. For all my 3/32 for the chef knives. The oyster knives, I like to go a little bit on the thicker side, so I go with 1/8. I used to do 5/32, but I like 1/8 inch steel for the oyster knives. Hmm. For the fillet knives and the thinner stuff, I've been using 1/16 a lot. And I've been that's been really, really successful in terms of something more flexible. So I've been using 1/16 for my fillet knives. I've been doing a charcuterie knife that's like super, super flexible. I like the 1/16. I actually made a chef knife that I use at home at a 1/16, and it's just a little too thin. It's a little bit too whippy as an everyday knife. I was thinking, you know what? I'm going to make 1/16 inch knives. But also the other thing is that when you're in the pinch grip, the spine is so thin that it also kind of it hurts and it kind of cuts you a little bit. I love 3/32, and for my kind of outdoor knives, I go with 1/8 inch. And once in a while, when I'll do, I have a big one that I use 3/16. But cool. Yeah, I like 3/32. I think 3/32 is a really very well. And this is all from 3/32 for my stainless.
Yeah.
You know, sometimes if I'm doing carbon steel, I'll do 1/8 because I like a little bit more material when I'm quenching.
Got you. So 3/32. I've just done the conversion. That's about 2.4 mil. So pretty much what I'm using as well, actually. Yeah.
I think it's a great size for culinary knives. It's a great size. It's a great size.
Okay, so let's talk about our next sponsor, which is the New Jersey Steel Baron. So if we're talking steel, that's the place to get it. They do steel in small billets. They do big sheets. Any dimension that you want, they can get hold of it. They've got a huge variety of round stock, of sheet steel, anything you need. They've also got a great water jet cutting service. And I know plenty of people use it. I know Jeff uses it for oyster knives and so on.
My Bandidos. All my Bandidos I use. They did a great job. And I didn't have to give them a computer drawing. I just gave them a template, and it was exact.
So go take a look. They've got a new website coming soon. But give them a call. Give them a call, whatever you need. They'll be able to sort you out. I said they've got the water jet cutting service. As Jeff said, that they'll even sort you up with doing the drawing. So if you're not very technical, they'll do all the CAD stuff for you. They've got it sorted. Steel in any dimension, any quantity as well. So if you want to try a different steel just to see how it'll work for you, give them a call. They've got some there for you.
There you go.
Crane's Community Showcase.
Okay, this is the bit where we'd like to give a shout out to people within the community. And mine this week, I'm going to go jump straight in, is Dunn_Bladeworks. So Dunn, D-U-N-N _Bladeworks. They hail from Fingal Ferguson's country. They're Irish. And he makes just really great kitchen knives. And both Japanese and Western styles, the fit and finish on these is just beautiful. So go take a look at Dunn Bladeworks. And just to have a look at some of the stuff. So look, beautiful hammers on the knives, just really, really clean, pretty looking work. Go take a look.
All right. Well, I'm going to give a shout out to someone we've ever mentioned today and who has been just been super supportive. Eric_Markman, Eric_Markman. He's a Dutch ABS journeyman smith. He makes beautiful knives. He makes a lot of, they're just, the handles are very robust. He does a lot of stuff, beautiful Damascus, a lot of, I'm looking at all of them right now. I love the way he carves his handles. His work is very, very stunning. He's a super guy. I got to meet him at the Blade Show. He listens to the podcast. He's apparently writing down a list of all the things he's mad about. Apparently he yells at the radio when I say things, which is, or whatever he's listening to. He yells at the podcast, which I appreciate. He's a super supportive guy. And Eric, I'm appreciative of everything you're doing. I'm looking at some of these handles, these knives, and they're incredible. His fit and finish, his shapes, they're classic. He makes a classic, beautiful fighting knives, and they are stunners. They're stunners. So Eric_Markman, there you go. Boom.
Go follow.
That's it.
Where's the beef?
This is the time where we yell or bitch or moan, or this is our really unnecessary, this is an unnecessary but enjoyable part of the podcast called Where's the Beef, where we bitch and moan. So I have to think about what I'm going to complain about. It'll probably be something dumb. And with that said, Craig, what's your beef?
Talking of dumb, Craig.
what's going on? Let me hold you up, and what's going on? What's are you pissed
beefs.
Off about?
So yesterday I spent a few hours walking around this knife show in roasting hot heat with babies crying. It was crazy. But shitty displays at knife shows. And I'm sure we've all seen them. Somebody has these tables and they sit behind their table, and some people go to great efforts and they present their work beautifully and it's really nice. There was people there and they'd obviously spent a lot of time making their knives. And they just sort of almost just threw them on a table. There was no order. You had to sort of dig through to have a look. And these knives are pretty expensive. And they're there and they're chatting to the storeholder next to them. They don't even, you know, have a look at who's looking at their knives. There's no conversation there. They've got a bottle of wine on the go, so they're, you know, they're quite happily having a chat with their neighbour. And I'm thinking, why the hell are you here? You're not presenting your knives in a good light at all. I mean, if you're here to sell knives, I don't think you're going to be selling any because you're not even holding eye contact with people looking at the knives. It was just baffling, just absolutely baffling. And there was plenty of them. And they're generally older guys. I said they're sitting back, they've got a drink on the go, and they're just there for the chat with their neighbor.
But they've done all the hard work. Maybe that's the finish line. Maybe that's the finish line of like... Because I used to be that way in terms of like when I was getting ready for art shows, I'd work, and then hand the work to the gallerist, and I'd be like, now it's your problem now. And I'd just like crash out.
But if you've done the hard work, this is the reveal. This is the exciting bit. This is sharing your work with people. And there was just no care whatsoever. It was just terrible. On this old cruddy table, and you know, I imagine the tables were put there ready for the people, but they didn't bring any sort of cloth to cover the table, and they'd literally just thrown their knives down, opened a bottle of wine, and they're cracking on with a good conversation with their neighbour. It was crazy to see. Crazy. That's my beef. That's my beef.
Well, but I mean, you know, I think that, you know, that's a pretty fair beef. You're looking for a little bit of razzle dazzle.
Yeah.
And these guys are all piddled out. They're just like, they don't care. Buy my knives or don't buy. My beef would be if I was the knife maker there, why the fuck am I selling knives next to other people selling knives? It's like selling hamburgers at a hamburger convention. God bless you. Well, I'm going to revisit an old beef, which is, you know what you should do. And this is something that we get a lot, and poor Mareko gets it a pile. But people sneak into our DMs, and then
into the DMs.
That's right. They're giving you unsolicited advice. Unsolicited advice. And the only thing recently, I just came back from, I picked my daughter up from summer camp, and we always go down to this famous Connecticut pizzeria. It's called Frank Pepe's. It's one of the first families that's brought pizza to the United States, and they brought it in New York, and I guess there's all these families, and they all busted up, and Frank Pepe went up in Connecticut, and a guy said, and I got, we go there every year, and we get, they're known for their tomato pies, but they're also known for their white clam pizza. So it's like, and they're unbelievable, and it's just an incredible pizza. And a guy snuck into my, I posted a picture, a guy snuck in, and he says, oh, you know what you should do? You should go down the street to, I already ate it. I'm not, what am I going to do? I'm going to read my DMs and say I fucked up. I should have gone somewhere else. I got to send the pizza back and go down the street because Dickface McGillicuddy told me that I'm going to the wrong pizza place. You know what you should do? You know what you do. Poor Mareko got it. Somebody who's giving him fritz about you should do is, you know, I know you're, this is an expensive knife. You should make knives for people to afford. Well, fuck you. How do you like that? You know what you should do? You should fuck away off. It's so stupid. This goes back to this whole idea of having conversations with people. You would never go up to someone and say, unless you were a sociopath, you'd never go up to someone and say, hey, I like your knives. You should make cheaper ones so I can afford them. You wouldn't do that. You would never do that. No, but you write on someone's thing, and it's just like, hey, listen, congratulations, but you know, you should make cheaper knives. Fuck you. I mean, seriously, I got a guy, I told you this a couple months ago. A guy says to me, he's like, when are you going to make knives for the working man? And I wrote back, how am I supposed to fill my yacht up? You know, it's just like, fuck you, man. Don't tell me what I should, just because you can't do it. That doesn't mean I have to do it.
We've talked before. I mean, there's levels to the game, but, you know, you sort of set a price on the level you're at. And yeah, we'd all love everybody to have our knives, but you know, there's a certain amount of time that goes into that. And
but everybody wants to be important into your decision making. Yeah. Like what pizza you're getting. Don't get, you know, God forbid we started with the pineapple pizza again. You know, everyone's sending me these I get more pineapple pizza DMs than anybody. It's like, it's ridiculous that people still talk about the goddamn pineapple pizza. Thanks again, Dave. Damascus Dave did this, and now all of a sudden I'm married to the goddamn pineapple pizza thing.
Well, you know, what I was going to ask you after the beefs.
Go ahead.
Generally, they get pretty, we get pretty down with the beefs, you know? I was then going to just change things up and say, what's the best thing you've eaten this week?
Oh.
But you've said as part of your beef.
Actually, I'll tell you what the best thing I cook. One of the best things I've made was coming back from Barcelona. The food in Barcelona is so great. And part of the reason why is because it's super simple, you know, clean ingredients put together in a smart way. And I've always liked the potato. It's called a tortilla in Spain. And it's not, the Mexican tortillas are what you wrap your tacos in. But a tortilla is like an omelet. And we're not going to go back into that whole omelet bullshit that we did a couple months ago.
The Spanish omelet, the thick one.
The Spanish omelet, yeah. You're basically cooking potatoes down and then you're making... you know, you're making this, it's potatoes and onions. There's different things you can do. And I made this potato tortilla, and you can eat it cold. It's great cold. I loved it. It was so delicious. But the Frank Pepe's clam pizza is like, it just blows your brains out. It's so good. And I know for some reason you're not supposed to have cheese with clams, but it was a fucking dynamite pizza. Oh, coal oven. So it's also, it's like, one of those pizzas that takes like 90 seconds or something like that. So it's like super crispy on the bottom and it's just a dynamite pizza. I love pizza. Needless to say, it was the first meat I'd had in almost a week. I've been on a cleanse.
Really?
I've been on a cleanse for the past 2 weeks. I had one, not slip up, but we went to a concert and I went to a friend's restaurant and I had some meat at his restaurant. But I was like, I've been vegetarian for the most part for 2 weeks and no booze either.
You feeling better for it?
You know what? When you're eating, the funny thing about cooking vegetarian is a lot of time is, you know, you learn how to cook things better. There were some nights where you're just like pushing it in and just, you know, not, just you're making it happen. Yeah. But I liked it. I'm trying to lose a little weight and I felt pretty good. Felt pretty good.
Yeah. We've started doing this meat-free Mondays, so we don't have meat on a Monday. Because we're big meat eaters. Over here in France as well, it's you know, everybody eats meat, every meal. is meat. So on a Monday, we try to have no meat at all. And yeah, we struggle, you know, after the sort of 4 or 5 weeks of, you know, making stuff that we know, we've struggled. So we've just bought
struggle
a load
for
of
a one of one meal a week and you're struggling?
No, the whole day. The whole day is it's a meat-free Monday. So, you know, you throughout the whole day. So we've just bought a bunch of new vegetarian cookbooks. And I'm working with a restaurant at the moment, and they sort of specialized in plant-based food. So I'm looking at their feed for inspiration as well. And it's difficult, but you're right. It pushes you out of your comfort zone, doesn't it? You're trying something new.
Sometimes, you know, the stupid part is talking about vegetarian. If you make something good and there's no meat in it, you don't call it vegetarian. It's just good.
Yeah, it's just
you know,
a meal,
so
yeah.
Yeah. I don't know. This isn't the very interesting thing, but, you know, it's... Look, what can you do?
I don't know. I like it. I think this needs to be a bit. Best thing you've eaten this week.
Best thing you've eaten this week. Yeah. Mm.
Nice. That's a show. So, we've got some news next week. We've got some big news next week.
We do?
So we're always asked, you know, could we go twice a week? Could we do whatever? Could we do longer shows? Could we do live shows? Could we do video and all the rest of it? But... it's difficult. We're busy. We've got stuff to do. And, you know, it takes a long time to do these episodes because then they're edited and the upload of it. It takes a long time. So we'd love to put up more content, but it's difficult. But I think we've got a solution. So we're just ironing out a few things now. But yeah, you may well be hearing more from us if that's what you want.
more talk of stick-ups and dildos and maybe a knife talk. Conversation or
something a bit different. So I said, so we're just ironing out a few things now, but I think next week we'll be able to reveal what we're up to.
That's it. There you go.
That's the show. Remember to follow our sponsors, have a look at the deals that we've got with them. What I'm going to do, I'm going to put a special page on the website as well with all the offers that we have with sponsors, because we've got quite a few offers at the moment, and it's good to have a resource everybody can go to and see what we can do. So yeah, so thanks for listening. We shall speak to you next week. Have a good week. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.